It seems that governments of all stripes want a piece of the glamorous, prosperous world of high-tech innovation. Innovation was a pillar of last week's federal budget, and just this week, the Trump administration announced innovation would get its own office. But my next guest warns that we need to stop drinking the innovation Kool-Aid. Andrew Russell is a technology historian and the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at SUNY Polytechnic Institute, and we've reached him by Skype in Utica, New York. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I am just fine. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So what is it about high-tech innovation that makes it so attractive to politicians who barely agree on anything, like Justin Trudeau and Donald Trump?
Well, there's a certain allure in the future, and there's a certain promise of expectations and solutions that haven't been created yet. So I think they all agree that that there's plenty of things in the past that they don't like, and they're all optimistic in one way or another that they can create a future that they would like. So innovation is a perfect mechanism for talking about that, because it's essentially become a meaningless empty box to set all sorts of promises and dreams into.
So if, and this seems to be something everyone agrees on, if we all see technological innovation as an indisputable public good, what's the danger in that?
Well, the danger, there's two dangers. And I've been writing about this with my friend and colleague, Lee Vinsel. And we've really honed our message about two different things. One is an actual economic risk that we take. So if we pour all of our money into new ventures and entrepreneurships and startups, every dollar spent on that, the theory goes, is a dollar less spent on things that we already have and things that we already need, such as social services, such as infrastructure, like the roads that have taken a beating here over the winter in upstate New York, bridges that are crumbling, and so on and so forth. So there's economic trade-offs involved in privileging innovation in the new. Second, there's also a cultural cost in it. Now, we live in societies in the U.S. and Canada where we like novelty, we like creativity, it holds a special place in our hearts. But if we shine the light only on that, then we cast into darkness the people and the kinds of work that go into maintaining the civilization that we have and that's made us so great. So that's why a lot of the time Lee and I talk about the maintainers, or the people whose work keeps us going. And keeps all of our social and technological, cultural, political institutions functioning.
The maintainers, as opposed to the creators or the innovators.
Yeah, so we hooked on to this idea of the maintainers a couple years ago. We were both reacting to this book by Walter Isaacson. His entree into computer history was called The Innovators, How a Group of Hackers, Geniuses, and Geeks Created the Digital Revolution. And so Lee and I were joking around about it one day, and I said, maybe we should write a counter volume called The Maintainers, How a Group of Standards Engineers, Bureaucrats, and Introverts Created Technologies That Kind of Work Most of the Time.
So a book that would be slightly less successful than the original.
That's why it was a joke. And that's why it was funny, because, you know, only books about heroes sell, you know, books about people who aren't heroes or just do boring things. I don't think they do as well, typically.
So who are the maintainers?
Well, we can look at specific people in specific roles and think of them as maintainers. So nurses are maintainers. They maintain our health. Teachers are maintainers. They maintain our children. In the technological world, electricians, plumbers, people who fix roads, linemen who repair the telephone lines that break when there's a lot of sleet. Those people are maintainers.
So clearly the problem here is that maintainers are not nearly as interesting or exciting as guys like Steve Jobs and Elon Musk, our tech gods. So I guess you can't really blame politicians for wanting to be associated with the Musks and the Jobses.
No, well, we can and we can't. I mean, on the one hand, they're politicians, and so our expectations for these creatures has been reduced over the years. On the other hand, they're leaders. We look up to them. We see them every day in the newspapers and TVs and on the internet, and they're supposed to tell us what we should care about, and they're supposed to set the moral agenda. They do set the economic agenda and political agenda for the country. And so would it really be so hard for them to celebrate working people and to celebrate the maintainers? I don't think it would be.
So how is progress possible if we don't embrace and celebrate innovation?
It's a good question. And I would say it's not. And here's an important part of the message and some of the finesse that we need to do in getting it out. So we're not merely critics of innovation. What we do a lot of the time is talk about innovation speak, and I'm using scare quotes there, the ways that people talk about innovation and use it as a crutch. We need new things, and we need new markets, and we need entrepreneurs to create those things. We're not saying that our society should banish those things. We don't want a tasteless, gray, mediocre world. Instead, we want a little bit more balance.
You've referred to our preoccupation with innovation as the cult of innovation.
Yeah. It really is sort of a mindless activity. It's not that unusual when you think about other buzzwords in business, you know, synergy or pick your buzzword. But it's reached this point in the past couple of decades where people just repeat it mindlessly and instinctively say, oh, if it's innovative, it's good. And if it's not innovative, we've got to get rid of it.
Well, we have tech leaders now talking about trying to extend human life, trying to get as close as possible to touching the hands of the gods and creating immortality. What should they be concentrating on? I mean, you talked before about infrastructure and the kind of low-level things that are badly in need of repair but get very little attention because they're not that sexy. What should people like Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg be talking about rather than trying to achieve immortality?
Well, lots of things. You know, immortality is a nice dream, but I think it's easy for them to focus on. It might sound weird, you know, immortality in the same breath is easy, but if they focus on that, they can just hide out in labs and think about science and technology and not really engage social problems, not really engage difficult cultural problems that have prevented progress in so many realms. So to stick with the health and medicine theme, I can think of a couple things that they would do. That is to tackle some public health challenges that face people in Africa, like malaria, for example. Another good example can be found in a book by Atul Gawande, who's a physician and a surgeon. And this book is called Being Mortal, and it's about the crisis of palliative care or end-of-life care, at least in America, where we don't really pay much attention to people in pain at or nearing the end of their lives. The culture of medicine and the culture of spending in this country is more on things like extending life or really exciting careers in, say, surgery. The kind of work about caring with a patient and being attentive to the patient's needs on a mundane level is cast in a low status, undesirable light. So, you know, could we do more to support those people and geriatrics in general? Yes. Does it involve sitting in a lab and dreaming about technologies in 50 years? No. No, it doesn't.
So what does it say about us as a society that we're celebrating people who, as you say, like to lock themselves up in labs and develop apps for other rich people to get excited about, and at the same time we have communities without potable drinking water, we have roads and bridges crumbling? What does it say about us?
Well, it's a way to read our values, and it's not a pretty story. It says that we're a little bit shallow. It says that we're materialistic. To be a little bit more optimistic, it says that we're dreamers. But dreamers are usually detached or a little bit closed off from the world that they live in. And so it's really their privilege that allows them to do that instead of engaging with the really tough problems that we have in communities all across this country and all across Canada as well.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Andrew Russell is the Dean of the College of Arts and Science at SUNY Polytechnic Institute.